Well, Frank had it all down. It's a pretty cool thing. Although he is so generous in trying to share with me and some others, John Wilson was the driving force that brought this about, bringing him here.
That was my next question to you.
How would you phrase the question?
Well, my question to you is, who, I've never been to a board meeting, and I'll probably never go to a board meeting. Who leads a board meeting? Do you as the rector, or does the president? What are the dynamics of that? And since he was pretty new at that point, John Wilson, right?
Oh, yes, he was.
So how did he figure in as a player?
Well, the rector sets the agenda, but the president is the chief executive officer, the CEO. Now, the way I saw that in the two New York Stock Exchange companies of which I was the CEO, I was the chairman, president, and CEO. Then you didn't have to worry about who's going to be set the agenda and present the accomplishments or the problems or the opportunities or whatever to the board for discussion and decision. The president is here every day. The board meets three times a year, usually here on the campus. During a big campaign, they're often off in other cities, Houston, Philadelphia, wherever, as they have been. Bob Huntley was a very strong president, and so is John Wilson. And I'm confident John Elrod, whom I've known since he came here, would do the same. You need that. He's here every day. The president is, in effect, chairman of the faculty, and the faculty, to me, is so critical. I've been the chairman of a big hospital and of this university, and in the bylaws, in both cases, it says the board has the final say. Technically, that's true, but unless you had a great medical staff or a great faculty, you're not going to attract any students, you're not going to have any kind of institution at all. You need the highest quality, and here in teaching, because we're not a great research-oriented institution, but the relationship of student to teacher, the teacher thing, and John Wilson, and every president we've had, I think, has brought that quality of the respect for the faculty, wanted to strengthen the faculty. And John Wilson did a particularly good job in that. But he saw immediately this admission problem, heard from the faculty and others. The board had discussed co-education a couple times before. I don't know that it ever came to, I don't think it ever came to a showdown vote. But it had been on the minds of people because it had been happening at many places that everybody admired. There were concerns about what it would do to the wonderful women's colleges all around us, which didn't hurt at all in my view, or I think in most people in there. And there were concerns about the alumni support, but my judgment, we gained maybe two people back for everyone we lost who was upset over the coincidence. But John really, and still to this day, I haven't attended a board meeting for a little while, but I'm sure the rector presides, but he turns it over to the president to make reports, who will delegate as each of his deans, the dean of the college, the dean of the law school, the dean of the commerce school, to report, and sometimes through the academic affairs committee, on admissions and statistics and particular aspects of it. That after all, this is an academic institution. It's not what we're about here is teaching, that's the critical part. And the president, still, I guess, he's the chief executive officer, and you turn to him in every case. Then the board goes home and doesn't come back for months. Now, there are committees, and there are some committees that where you have a lot of specialized strength. The investment committee, you've got people from Tom Broaddus to Rupert Johnson that help run great big companies and invest billions for other people. So when you look at the endowment here, you look at the financial part. I've been on lots of what I'd call outside boards and of Elia Musker Institute, charitable institutions, those that you can take a tax deduction if you give them money. And institutional accounting is different than the P&L statement in a normal business thing. But both Bob Huntley and John Wilson were superb, sort of their own chief financial officers. Mm-hmm. Even though we had very good, and still have today, very good financial department. They understood the audit function, understood the budget function very well. I'm sure John Elrod does too, and had a lot of experience. It's a little different in an educational institution than in a business.
Sure.
But not that much.
Well, now, going back into that room on that day, which I think is such a dramatic event, when that decision was made to go with a two-thirds vote, yes. Was there any dissension on that? Did anyone feel that was not appropriate?
No, I announced that and said Chris Compton and I had agreed on that, and I guess we were sort of recognized as leaders of the two factions in the...
How about John Wilson? Did you talk it over with him?
No, I don't recall that I know I would have said to him, John, if this goes very narrowly, Kopi is going to make a motion to reconsider, and many of us who voted for co-education are then going to vote against it, mm-hmm. and we're all going to pledge to get together to work on it. I'm sure I told him that. But, you know, you kind of call it. I had taken account in my own mind from the days before, and I was pretty sure that we had enough, and I think I did a quick mental calculation. I think I knew we could do two-thirds. Mm-hmm. That may be why I agreed to that so quickly without any great discussion or anything. I didn't try to bargain Chris to 55% or 60%, 66 and two-thirds is fine. Mm-hmm. The question I've always had in my mind, suppose he had said three-fourths,
Wouldn't have done it, would it?
Well, no, yeah, no, it wouldn't have. It would have taken 18, one-fourth of 24 is 6, it would have taken 18. But there might have been one more vote out there if we'd had that, you know. Maybe you would have... You would need it of what they call a whip in the Congress and Senate to struggle to get one more vote. I don't know.
Well,
excuse me.
It seems to have been a very charged experience.
It was revolutionary, 200 years plus. That institution is 200 years old in 1949, and here, few more years than that too, to make such a sea change, a watershed, change the whole perception of everybody, and the students rose up against you. Now they did a couple. Somebody put No Marthas up on Old George, up on top of Washington. They only did one really clever thing, which encouraged me. You've heard of this clever thing the kids at Caltech do, change the scoreboard in the Rose Bowl by some computer magic from long distance and put up some message that Caltech is playing MIT or something like that with it. They don't even have a football team. But some of the kids here somehow found out and got a copy of the inaugural speech John Wilson had made when he was sworn in as president of Wells College, an all-female college, in which his speech, the thrust of his speech and the drive, entirely related to why you don't need co-education. and they reprinted that and sent it around to all the board, and it was done by the students. And I said, John, you're going to have to explain this. This is your speech, pal. I'm not touching this. But what it does show that we got great kids here, anybody bright enough to dig that out, God knows I never would have thought of that going back and looking at what you said.
Isn't that clever?
That many years ago, it was very clever. It was there were some nasty things said, a few, lots of letters to answer and things. But I was so proud of the fact that, hey, I'm not really worried about this student body. Even if this doesn't go through, these kids are going to be able to handle things. Looks all right to me. It was great.
So what happened?
A little anecdotal, I know, but it was great fun.
Oh, no, that's what I'm after, those anecdotes. So what happened then? Tell me, as it unfolded over the next couple of years.
You know, a whole committee, including Penn, they went around and studied everything from Colgate, which had some problems, and others, whether you put up more lights? Do you put separate dorms? Do you do, you know, what do you do about the... Turned out that the Warner Center was easy to divide in women's locker room and men's locker room and other things. And you're starting with a school 50 to 1600, and you only took about 100 the first year, I think, out of 400, maybe more. Anyhow, it got to the point pretty quickly where we're still at 1,000 men and 600 young women. If you went way down in the number of young men, then you don't have a football team or a lacrosse team and other things like that. So you did it over for the prep school that my son is the college counselor in now, did it over 12 years. They started a kindergarten.
Hmm.
And every year, you know, added to the class till they got to the full thing. So it took a long time to get enough people to have a girls' cross-country team or swimming team to do all of that. And it just worked splendidly from the beginning. The number of applications almost immediately overwhelmed everybody, young men and young women, who wanted to be here. And there's no question, I suppose the women in the first year class come from pioneer stock. They wanted to be in that first class.
Tell me more about that.
Well, that is an internal matter of the Bill Hartog and the president. I didn't, the board doesn't participate a lot in that. You cannot. The decision has got to be made on the basis of what's best for the university. Now, we have always had a policy that sons and now daughters of graduates and residents of Rockbridge County, and I suppose maybe in some minority situations, do not compete in the regular pool, but it's got to be demonstrable that they can do the work. And I think that's true of almost every college that I know, that they took that and then even then you turn down lots of prominent donors and alumni, the sons and daughters of, and it's very, very difficult. I went through this with Bob Huntley, with Robert E. Lee IV's son, Robert E. Lee V. And how do you do that? Bob went to see him and said, you know, we're never going to turn down anybody named Robert E. Lee V, Bob, but this is the wrong place for you to send this boy, and told him why and explained. That young man went to Hampton, Sydney, did well. He's a coach. I think now I see Bob once in a while. And he tells me how proud he is of his son. Roger Budd's son, Bill Brock, who's in the cabinet. Bill Brock told me it was the finest thing. We did the right thing because that young man. But some people get very, very bitter about that, you know. And some of them have been five generations of Washington and Lee. Oh, so that it's, and then we exacerbated that part of the problem when we went co-ed because of the number of applicants way up, and the number of spots are still the same, in fact reduced for young men. Mm-hmm. So it made it doubly difficult when we did that. But the board can't interfere with that. Now you could write letters. I would not write a letter about any young person unless I knew him, saw him, interviewed him personally. It doesn't do me any good to write Bill Hartog and say, hey, this kid's got wonderful parents. He will immediately write me back and say, Jim, we're not admitting the parents. You know, I want you to imagine. And he used to kid me. In fact, I kid him. What he did, I recommended some people, and they kidded over there. My batting average was 0 for 17 or something like that. What Bill was doing was, I think, turning down all kinds of people that I might have recommended. And then that gave him this leeway with everybody else on the board. He would say, hey, I've already turned down Jim's guy, who is much better qualified than yours, and he's the rector. I cannot take yours. I said, you're using me as a ploy. I want you to stop doing that. So I wrote him about a young man that had a 2 handicap, could be his partner at golf, and he could beat everybody else around here, which is one of Hartog's loves, and he took him right away. So I kidded him then what he was doing, but it's a doubly difficult thing, you know.
I understand that you couldn't really participate in it But you did watch. What did you see happen when those girls started coming here?
Well, I saw the grade point average and the SATs going up, and the campus didn't look a lot different. There'd always been girls from Sweetbriar. My son married a Sweetbriar girl, typical kind of thing that you came to Washington and you met a girl from Hollins or Sweetbriar. Any number of people on the board and others that I know, and my daughter-in-law was a Sweetbriar grad, so there were always girls around. Now they just didn't have to drive down the road to Hollins or over the mountain to Sweetbriar or to Hampton, Sydney or someplace. I had sort of on the periphery seen it at places, schools around Philadelphia that I knew well, and watched Bryn Mawr. I live in Bryn Mawr. Harris Wofford, who was president there for a long time, is a good friend of mine. He appointed me on a committee to look at some of their financial problems, which they had, which were serious. And I belong to their library at Haverford College Library thing, because you send them a small contribution and you get to go to some, to use the library, and you get to go to pictures. So I had watched it started so slow to hear in the numbers, you know, socially changing. Just now, getting around to the sororities, for example, there weren't enough for that to happen. And I've been off the board now 6 years, or it will be 6 years in October. And so I still try to watch it, but you know, it's the place is reputation. If you look at not only the U.S. News and World Report, all those kind of things, you know, it's gotten superb. But so many other places, and the law school I look at, particularly, I just wrote Dean Sullivan about a couple young men there. One of them is this same one that had the two handicaps that Hartog took. He's been out as a graduate and been working at KPMG, Pete Marwick as a CPA. Now he decided he wants to go to law school, and he's a fine young man and proud of his. I know why he wants to live here 7 years. He was here 4 years, but he wants to come back three more and do it.
I like that expression, a seven-year man.
They use that a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you hear that a lot. That gives him higher credentials, you know, greater weight. And
so we're only starting to have seven-year women. We probably only have...
That's true. It's very true.
Less than a handful at this point.
Yeah, of course.
Well, now, were you here for the first graduation that included?
No, I rarely came to graduate. The graduation has always been the president's... tradition is he was the speaker, and he awards the degrees, and the board never participated much, at least in my time, in March graduation. I came, I proposed somebody for an honorary degree, and I was on that committee as long as I was director, and then they made me write the citation, which I did, and I came with him and his wife, and went to the dean's dinner the night before, which was wonderful and delightful, and we had it was a glorious time, and I enjoyed it very much. But basically, I did not ever come to graduation. I was here enough, it seemed to me, and that was an academic function, and that belonged to the parents. Of course, I came to my son's graduation, my son-in-law's graduation. I went to my daughter, who graduated from Swarthmore after three children, went back to Bryn Mawr and got a master's degree. I just went to that graduation not long ago. So, you know, it's now I'm getting ready to start with grandchildren. So I've done my share of graduations. I guess that's it.
Well, now you've mentioned your son coming here a couple of times. Yeah. Tell me about that being a parent and having that be a possibility for your child?
Yeah, well, I was very pleased, of course. I don't know how much influence that I hope I didn't, that he made his own choice, and I think he did. We traveled around, and we looked at Davidson, and we looked at a number of schools in Ohio, like Denison, and some. He'd gone to Haverford School, which is a good prep school, in the suburban Philadelphia, next door to Bryn Mawr almost, which they're all day schools now, and an earlier time they had boarding students, and they were started as the school my two daughters went to. Baldwin was a preparatory school for Bryn Mawr, and Haverford was a preparatory school for Haverford College. Mm-hmm. And he made his own mind, and he joined Sigma Chi, and so I guess he's very much like me, I don't know, but I tried to get him to go to law school, I told him I'd quit running my business and start a practice, and I'd bring in the clients, and he could do the work. He had no, and neither of my daughters. I tried that on both my daughters and did not succeed. My son wanted to be a teacher, and he got his master's degree, and he loves being a college counselor. He's been in three schools. He was out in La Jolla for 5 years at a magnificent place called the Bishop School.
What a nice place to be.
Oh, I visited there as much as I could. It's absolutely
I'll bet you did.
And, but I kept hoping he had three children, and then, you know, I couldn't see that often. I kept hoping somebody in Atlanta or Boston would offer him a job and get back in the East Coast. And lo and behold, Penn Charter, which is an old, another Quaker founded school like the Bryn Mawr and Hamilton Swarthmore, offered him the same job in Philadelphia, and he moved back to Philadelphia.
So oh, bet you were delighted.
I regained three grandchildren there, right? And it's great. But, you know, I loved, I came to all the Parents' Day things as I did my daughters when I could, especially a daughter at Berkeley at that time. I had a lot of business on the West Coast, so I'd get through at L.A., I'd go up and spend a weekend with her in San Francisco or Berkeley, and I went to the function. That was a troubling time for parents, although most of the real problems at Berkeley had sort of calmed down by that time. But as a parent, you know, you really, that far away from home and what you read about it wasn't like Washington, L.A. Or Swarthmore. Even.
Well, now...
Although at Swarthmore, the president of the college dropped dead in his chair at his office while besieged by a bunch of students in the 60s taking over his office. So even the Quakers with their... They could have... So it wasn't just Berkeley. The 60s were a terrible time. You know, every place must have been. I'm glad I survived what I was doing.
Well... When you came back as a parent,
right.
Did you find that you were among many other parents who were alumni?
Oh, yeah. And, of course, you can look in the alumni magazine at the end of each year, their fathers and grandfathers standing behind them, the pictures. I think Washington Lee, as much as anybody knows, has done a great job in continuing to accept sons and now daughters of graduates.
I find those photographs very touching when
I see them. They absolutely are. In fact, I've got a granddaughter here this summer. She's going to be a rising senior next year. She's a senior at prep school. And she is looking at a lot of places. And I don't think Washington, living in Philadelphia, they tend, if they look at a small college, they look towards Williams, Amherst, Wesley, and in that direction more than the South. But she's going to look at Emory and Richmond. And that's going to be tough competition. And I don't know. Since her father went here and I went here, and I don't know how, whether she might want to do something on her own. Hey, I don't want to just go down there and see that name Ballingy up on the wall here and there. Too much would be expected of me. I've been the oldest child in my family. I suppose that may be a problem for her. And I'm going to understand.
And it's not exactly Smith, you know, it's not like she can pretend she's not related.
No, that's true. But I'm going to understand if she decides to go someplace else. But I've got 8 grandchildren, so I figure I may get lucky one or two.
Well, my guess is at the rate you're going, you'll be around for great-grandchildren, too.
Oh, I don't know. I hope. I'm 73 now, and I don't know. I've had 37 years of rheumatoid arthritis, which I've had lots of orthopedic operations and replacements. But even Frank will tell you, the way I used to walk, I had remarkable improvement and sort of remission and doing well.
That's great.
It is great.
That's wonderful. Well, I know you've had a long drive today, and I know you're probably ready to relax. Is there anything more? And I feel like I've gotten wonderful information from you. I can already see it on the page. So is there anything more you'd like to talk about?
No, if I... If I think of anything, I'll drop you a note. I've always believed in the theory that John Wilson always proclaimed, that life is like a relay race. Our predecessors carried the baton, and now it's handed it off to this generation. And I strongly believe this. I probably first heard Dr. Gaines say this, you know, starting with the importance of George Washington's gift to every student here, that this place was here and ready for me when I came here in 1946, with the wonderful buildings, this beautiful, incomparable setting of the front campus and the colonnade. To walk down that every day, just absolutely inspiring and gorgeous, with great faculty and a great program, because people worked and gave money and gave their time and their talent and their treasure and all. And I did nothing. That I just came here as a kid out of, hillbilly kid out of West Virginia, who matured a little bit because he'd been overseas in the infantry, you know. But that is a clear obligation for me and those of my generation to do the same thing for the next generation, the next generation. Every generation owes its dues, and sometimes that's difficult to get across to people. And I know it's strange, my wife and I have had this discussion. I think we ought to be giving more money to this little college in West Virginia we both went to. It's where we met. She's a strong advocate that it's wasted, that we ought to just keep giving it to Washington Lee, that you know you're going to get more bang for the buck here. This is going to do more good. It's going to help. I said, the poor little kid struggling in the mountains over there, they're never going to get any place, and never. And she might be right about it. Maybe. That, and in fact, we have done substantially more here than we have for that place. And I suppose it'll continue that, because for a while I thought it was going to fail. I thought it was going to fold up. And nobody wants to start pouring money into a ship that's on its way sinking, you know. I see it as more of a moral dilemma than she does. She's pretty clear-eyed about this, and her vision of what's going to be useful and helpful and where it's going to do some good is that this is the place. And she,
well, you have a pretty sound investment here.
Yeah, but there's no question about that. We've already got a big investment of son and son-in-law and me, and all our years of the friendships. That in recent years, we've taken every trip with the many of the trips, the alumni college thing, which has cemented things all over again. And in fact, I'm getting ready to go early next month with Rob to Jerusalem and Petra, Amman, and even Damascus, and then we're going to England in the summer.
Oh, may I carry your bags? I would love to go on that trip.
That trip is great. Our oldest daughter, the Berkeley one, married an Englishman and lives down in Somerset nearby, Moth, as they would call it.
Yes.
And we have two grandchildren there that have a wonderful English accent that is delightful. So we're going to even stay some time and spend a week with them afterwards, probably.
Oh, that's wonderful. And
it will be great, I think. So I went, first went there in 1944 on the QE-1 with 14,999 other troops, a little different than sailing on the QE-2 today. But, you know, and it, with all their problems of mad cow disease now and everything else, everything that my life centered on, that I liked, literature and law and language, all came from what you could properly call the mother country to many of us there, I guess. I've loved it every. I've been there many times since, more than 50 years now.
Yes. My husband and I keep going back, and every time we say, we really ought to go somewhere else, but why?
Yeah.
We love it there so much.
That's right. Well, I can't think of anything else that I have. It's obvious, you know, if you go over and look at that benefactor's wall and see the people that have outpoured it, that Ernie Williams and Jerry Linton, the Lewises, and they're so wonderful. Both of them served on the board with me. Never once ever said to me, Jim, you owe us, you ought to do this for us because of what we've done. I tried never to forget. They were our largest benefactors for many years now. I've paced a little, but I think that's important. And,
It's a wonderful family here, and I'm really getting a lot of pleasure in getting to meet these people.
Well, I think the integrity, too, of the admissions process is such that Bill Hartog and his group, maybe with some influence from the president and the dean and others, really make those decisions. I know once I was at a had a difficult thing. There was a young man whom I had never met, but I knew his father well. His father had been president of the American Bar Association. As a young man, had worked up through the ranks in Tampa, Florida. He was a real overachiever. So was the boy's mother. The boy, I guess, kind of rebelled against that. And in a prep school, out of 220 kids, he was like 210. But his SATs were sky high. I mean, way up there, like 1,400 or something like that. His father was known to everybody. A couple of our leading trustees in Atlanta, Lewis Powell, knew me well, called me, and as I'd worked with him in the junior bar when we both started out. And Bill resisted this from the beginning, saying, we're not a remedial institution. We're not here to straighten that kid out, Jim. Then I remember Dean Gilliam's favorite thing, the thicker the file, the thicker the boy. That meant the more letters that came in from the board and so on. I mean, the father flew up here, had a terrible fright, got the plane canceled, finally got in the middle of the night, came over here, and Bill Hartog wouldn't even see him, put him off to somebody else to interview him. He's a very important guy in Tampa. And John Robinson, who's on the board now, he had the same experience. Bill, I don't think the father speak to him. I've never heard from the father since then. We turned the kid down flat. He went off. I don't think he's turned. I think Bill Hartog was exactly right. I don't think he's turned out to be anything. Mm-hmm. Now there's some of them, I don't know how he does it. My son, who went to Washington, he was a college counselor. Just he had a young man that we turned down flat and Davidson took. And I think my son would agree we should have turned him down even though he's now president of the student body at Davidson. Probably a great kid. The father was atrocious in writing the letters, criticizing Bingley and everything. I don't know how, maybe Davidson takes more at-risk cases or something, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a whole mystery to me how you've got three times as many fully qualified people as you can handle, how you pick. Now I know.
It's not an enviable job.
I know he doesn't want well-rounded kids, he wants a well-rounded class. So he needs a couple of cello players and he needs a great lacrosse player and he needs an editor for the newspaper and he needs few other things to try to get the class as well-rounded. The big problem now, I don't know whether you've heard this, just between us and the board, is this question of whether you should have a sex-blind admissions policy or stay at this 1,600. And my friend Pat McPherson, who's president of Bryn Mawr College, said to me, Jim, you should have done that a long time ago and you'll have more women than men. I said, that's what everybody's afraid of.
What do you think on that subject?
Yeah, I haven't studied any of the news. It all came up since we were pretty clear in the beginning that we were going to do that, how gradually we were going to do this, maybe what we're going to work up to, and we're at that point, 600 to 1,000, and that was the objective. It's maybe like Frank Zen Buddhism or whatever he was quoting to me a minute ago. You achieve success when you arrive where you're supposed to arrive, whether you realize it or not, and we're at that point. There are some people on the board that think it ought to just stay that way, I know, and I know they've voiced it to me that they're not going to be very happy if that changes. And I said, well, you know, I think if you change it, I don't think it'd end up much different. I think Bill Hartog could control that. He can do it the way he, these days, I watch this closely because my son being a college counselor, what he does with all of his recommendations and how he goes to these meetings with Hartog and others. They have a prep, really good prep school, college counselor, and really good colleges. I think they get off and play golf and things and stuff, tell you the truth. Now they have a big thing, they meet up in New England every year and discuss these things between themselves. But I think these days with the increase every place in the early decisions, Bill has his class fixed with the early decision, and then he's got his wait list at the end. Mm-hmm. You know, it looks like a science better than booking hotel rooms and airplane tickets. How do you come out? Never too many and never too few. You have too many, you don't have housing for them. You have too few, you ruin your budget. You've got to come out right where you want to come out every place. But it's a very tough thing. I I probably would be very conservative and hold on to the way it's, because it's going so well. You don't tinker around with great success here.
Although, yeah, but they tinkered 10 years ago. You tinkered 10 years
yeah,
ago.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah, and you put your finger right on the point. You get older and you get much more conservative. I can remember when I was young, I would push what money I had in the middle of the table, and if the deal fell apart, I'd know I had lots of years to make it up. Mm-hmm. And something coming along later, you don't have that later. You're exactly right about that. Probably would, but I don't know that. I don't know that going to sex blind admission. I mean, I think Bill could do that now, except I guess the board has said to him, "Hey, we want 600 women and 1,000 mm-hmm. men." Mm-hmm. Mostly, what the board has said to him, we don't want more than 1,600. Mm-hmm. We're going to keep this place small and keep the student-teacher ratio. You could balance the budget easily by taking 2,000. You could increase the class size a little bigger without adding any faculty, mm-hmm. without adding any chairs in many of those classrooms or any other facilities. Some dormitory rooms or something you might need, or housing, and you could really enhance your budget. I've seen some schools do that, do it that way. But the board was firm. We, part of the secret of this place, the charm of the place, is the size of the great keeper. And one time, I can remember, we said, we want 1,600, the 1,600 and first student that comes here this next year lives with the Hartogs, the 1,602nd lives in Lee House with the president.
That's great.
Well,
thank you so much.
I've read long enough. Thank you, man.
That's a great